This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Now that Republicans are fully in control of all state lawmaking, some serious change is on the way. After long pent-up demand, much on social conservatives' agenda seems almost certain to become law, from expanding gun rights to restricting abortions to protecting private adoption agencies who want to discriminate based on religious convictions. If those issues don't appeal, there are plenty of others that might, from online sales tax to school budget controversies to welfare drug screening, just to name a few. Our crack team of analysts is ready to bring you up to speed on as many of the latest developments coming out of Richmond as possible. And since we're getting close to a critical landmark in this year's General Assembly session, we'll also be making sure you know how to share your views with your state lawmakers with just a couple of clicks of your computer mouse. It's all coming up right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Abortion, adoption, the Amazon tax, gun rights, religious rights, GPS, privacy rights, the death penalty, children's mental health, and school funding cuts that may or may not actually be cuts in funding. These are just some of the hot-button issues under consideration in the state capitol as the Virginia General Assembly zeroes in on its all-important crossover day coming up this year on February 14th, Valentine's Day. So it's a short time away. If you've got comments or questions about any of the issues I've just mentioned or any other Virginia political issues that I did not yet mention, you are invited to join this hour's conversation at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Political reporter Anita Kumar is with us from The Washington Post. Politics and public policy professor Bob Roberts is with us from James Madison University. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The third member of our usual political analyst team, Bob Gibson, is actually recovering from a bout of illness. Apparently just thinking about all the heat going on in Richmond these days has given him a fever. We are certainly wishing him a speedy recovery. And by the way, if you want to write your own well wishes to Mr. Gibson or comment on any political hot issue, you can do either or both on our Facebook page, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Now, the other Bob, Dr. Bob, Bob Roberts. For any who might not be intimately familiar with the inner workings of Richmond, Bob, could you please explain just what crossover day is and why it's so important?
Simply, it's the bills of one chamber goes to the other chamber for consideration. And therefore, if the bill doesn't go over to the other chamber, it's hard to pass a law. So in a sense, that's what it is. Each side passes their legislation for the other side to consider it. Then theoretically, they amend it, and therefore they work out the legislative process.
So crossover day is the day after which there's no more new stuff allowed.
In theory.
In essence, if you have a bill that by crossover day, and this year it's Tuesday, February 14th, if you have a piece of proposed legislation and it has not been approved in the Senate yet, or it has not been approved in the House yet, it's not going anywhere this year. Only a bill that has at least passed the Senate or at least passed the House, with the exception of budget matters.
Correct.
Could we make it any more complicated?
Nope.
Anita Kumar, let's talk about adoption and abortion. Which one do you want to go for first?
It doesn't matter. How about abortion?
Okay. What's happening there?
Well, just like every other year, there's many bills that are introduced. The one that's sort of gotten a lot of attention because it's now passed both chambers, or at least a version has passed both chambers, is requiring women who want to have abortions to have an ultrasound before the abortion. And it was very much on party lines. Republicans have been trying to get this measure through for a number of years, and as you know, they now have control both chambers, and so this is the first year that it's actually passed. The governor, Governor Bob McDonnell, Republican, has said he's going to sign the bill.
And those who oppose this have said that it is more intrusive even than what some people might think at first blush, because for many women who are pregnant and are thinking about an abortion, without getting too gynecological here, there sometimes is required a internal exam to find out how far along they are, which the bill says you have to know how far along you are.
Right, correct. And I think if it's pretty early on, that's the way you have to do it. So there was talk about that. But I think there was an overall thought on the other side. The critics say it's between the woman and her doctor. It shouldn't be required by government to do this. You know, if she wants to get one, get one. Or if he or she thinks she should have one, then she should have one. I mean, they basically were saying it was too much government.
There's also a question of cost.
That's a big question.
Some insurance companies are not going to pay for this, which means if they believe it's selective and not necessary, and this is not necessary if the pregnancy is, according to experts, early, then the insurance company may not pay for it,
That's right, and that actually is the number one question I've gotten in the last week or so since this has happened, and it's sort of unclear. I mean, basically, we need to go to some insurance companies and find out what they would do.
Right.
I think it would be hit or miss. It would just sort of depend.
Right. Now, and also, it's important to understand, like 8 other states who have similar laws, that there is no requirement that the woman actually view.
And there is not a requirement here either.
Right.
But it does become a matter of her permanent medical record. She has to sign a form saying whether or not she's willing to view it, and then it's entered into her file.
Right.
According to this law.
But that file is that file would be under heavy privacy protection under the federal law.
Right.
But the fact is they couldn't constitutionally require the woman to look at the sonogram, and therefore no state does that. But the finance question is significant. In other words, that if insurance companies aren't going to pay this, I'm not sure what the cost of a sonogram is, but it's not going to be cheap. And therefore, critics are saying that this is a burden on particularly poor women or women without insurance to be forced to instance, pay for a procedure that maybe their doctor will not require.
So almost certain to become law now in Virginia because it has passed both chambers, the House of Delegates and the Senate. The governor says he's going to sign it. If you have a comment on that issue or any other, we are hoping to hear your voice here on Virginia Insight at 1-888-WMRA-TALK, 1-888-967-2825. The adoption issue that I ask you about, Anita, we'll get back to in just a moment because we're already getting some calls. So let's go next to Mark in Harrisonburg. Thank you, sir, for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Hey, thanks for having me. I wanted to bring up the issue of lifting the Sunday hunting ban in Virginia. We remain one of just a handful of states in the entire country that still has a blanket ban on Sunday hunting. And I think it was last week or maybe the week before, the Senate passed 29-11 a bill that would lift that ban on private property and public water, not on public land, but on private land and public water. One of our local delegates, Tony Wilt, stands on a House subcommittee or sits on a House subcommittee that is currently blocking several of these bills to lift this ban, which the governor and the Department of Game and Fisheries stand in favor of. And I was hoping we could get some of our local listeners who might be in favor of lifting the ban to get in contact with Mr. Wilt and get these bills heard in front of the full public house.
Anita, update us on the status of that. As Mark said, it did pass the Senate, but I thought it was killed.
It was,
the House.
It was killed. Now, of course, because it passed in the Senate, not to get too technical here, there's still a shot it could happen. If the Senate bill comes over to the House and they change their mind, they could reconsider it. But talking to the folks, and there's a huge coalition on the side of having Sunday hunting, talking to those folks, they have looked around, talked to people. There just aren't the votes in the House, or at least on this subcommittee that it's gone to pass it out and keep it going. So it's unlikely to happen this year, which is interesting, because at the beginning of session, people said this was the year. The governor had come out and said he would support it. The lieutenant governor supports it. The attorney general supports it. A lot of people do support it, but it does not look like it's going anywhere.
But Bob Roberts, churches do not.
Religious groups do not.
And they have a lot of influence, apparently, in the House.
They clearly do. The belief is it's a distraction to Sunday, which should be the Sabbath for some religions, not all religions. And there are also groups of private property owners who are also upset about it, because they're fearful that if there are hunters out on property, that it may limit their ability to do other Sunday recreational activities.
But does this largely come down to, in terms of who's influencing
right.
certain members of right. the Republican majority in the House,
right.
that the fear of church leaders that if Mark and his friends were allowed to hunt on Sunday, they would no longer go to church and church attendance numbers would go down?
In theory. That's the only explanation I could see why there's such opposition in the House, since it had overwhelming support by all the state political leaders. I mean, it is really strange that the House would try to kill this.
Mark, thank you so much for your call. And I have a follow-up here that I want to make sure everybody hears about because it relates to something that I heard you say a moment ago. We're doing something a little bit different on our web pages with this particular edition of a political update for Virginia. And that is that we are trying to make it as easy as possible for you to locate who to talk to in the state capitol, who represents you in the state Senate and in the House of Delegates. So if you go to the Virginia Insight page at WMRA.org, we've got easy-to-follow links for you to use so that you can determine the names of your state lawmakers, state senator, and House of Delegates member, as well as how to contact them by email, by letter, or by phone. And that's on the Virginia Insight webpage at WMRA.org. You can also find a similar link on our Virginia Insight Facebook page if you go to where we're listed there on Facebook as WMRA's Virginia Insight and just scroll down a bit. It's where the picture of the red elephant and the blue donkey are butting heads. There is a link there also for how you define your state legislator, whether you want to support Mark's view about lifting the ban on Sunday hunting or any other issue that you want to have your voice heard by your state lawmaker, please do avail yourself of those links after the show is over, because right now you want to call us, don't you, and tell us what you think at 888-WMRA, 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. Talking about religion, Anita Kumar from the Washington Post, that also has to do with the adoption issue in the state legislature,
yes,
doesn't it?
That's right. And actually today that bill passed, so now it's passed both the House and the Senate. And let me tell you what it is. There's a lot of confusion about this bill, and it's kind of complicated. But the bottom line is it says that the private adoption agencies in the state, and there are almost 80 of them, they do get money from the state for foster care and adoption services, that those private agencies could say they don't want to work with prospective parents based on a variety of religious or moral reasons. So you can define those in different ways. It could be an agency that doesn't want to work with a certain religion, you know, person of a certain faith, or thinks that adoptive parents should be married, doesn't work with single people. And then, of course, the reason that everybody thinks this bill came through is that you could turn away parents who, based on their sexual orientation. So you could turn away parents who are gay. That's what's gotten the most attention, but it's actually much broader than that.
So if I'm Mormon and there is an adoption agency run by a Lutheran church,
right,
and Lutherans want only what they consider to be good Protestants, and they and this particular denomination
right.
maybe doesn't think
right.
of Mormons
right.
that way, then I could be prevented from adopting through that agency.
Yes,
right.
And of course, just through that agency. There, as I indicated, there's a number of agencies as well as this local social services that do have foster care and adoption.
Or let's say you have a Jewish organization that places children. They may want to only place in Jewish families. So in a sense, it basically says if I have a religious order group that is running an adoption service, they're free to basically use any criteria they wish to basically decide who gets the child or not.
Mm-hmm.
But that does not include race, does it?
There's a couple protections under the federal government,
and
that includes race. National origin, you know, things that you've heard about that the federal government protects.
So if a private agency doesn't like my religion, doesn't like my sexual orientation, doesn't like my morals, it now would have state protection to keep me from becoming an adoptive parent through that agency. And the status of this bill is that
it's actually a version, which they're the same version, has passed the House now and the Senate. So once some technical things are done, it heads to the governor and he has indicated he will sign it.
We've got lots of stuff to talk about what's happening with K-12 education. We'll get to that when we return in a bit more than 1 minute. So we're going to be jumping around a lot. And if we mention an issue and then leave it and go on to something else or several something else's, but you still want to talk about that issue, you're still welcome to call in at 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. With us, Richmond-based political reporter Anita Kumar of The Washington Post, and from James Madison University, politics and public administration specialist Bob Roberts. I'm Tom Graham. Here on Facebook from Ron, he lists many what he considers top issues. Make the state a gun walhalla for weapons trafficking along the East Coast again. Deny women any right for their own control over their reproductive organs. Further disenfranchise voters and throw up more barriers to vote. Power sharing is an act of weakness, and total one-party rule is preferred even if the Senate is split evenly. He goes on at some length here, I guess, indicating that he's not much in favor of Republican control of government.
Interesting. No, I think it's more significant than that. What's fascinating about what's going on in the, from my view, the General Assembly is if you look at how Obama's holding basically a narrow lead or even in the presidential race in Virginia, and you look at Tim Kaine, who is holding his own with Senator Allen in Virginia, and then you look at the behavior of the General Assembly, the Republicans in the General Assembly, there seems to be two worlds out there. One world is that the Republicans believe they have a major mandate to pursue what I consider a fairly radical agenda in terms of social issues, guns, abortion, etc. And on the other hand, the Virginia electorate in as a total is not nearly as conservative as the General Assembly. And that's fascinating. I mean, you would in most states where you have this, you would not have this the population as a whole so split down the middle if the legislature is doing what it's doing, because what happens is if the legislature acts like this, it will hurt the Republican Party because there are enough citizens who are opposed to this that there'll be a backlash. But that does not seem to concern the governor or anyone in the Republican Party right now.
I'd actually kind of disagree with that.
Okay.
Some of the more, if you want to call it, if the word you use is more conservative or more extreme or whatever bills, they've already died. Some of those have already died. And so perhaps they think the ones that are passing that the governor has indicated he would sign are, clearly they are conservative or they are, you know, favored by Republicans, but they aren't necessarily the ones that some people would think are the most extreme. And I think he's conveyed his message pretty clearly. Sure, we can do these bills, but this isn't everything. You know, don't overreach. That's what he keeps saying.
One of the ones that died was the proposal to allow guns on college campuses?
Correct. He had indicated very early on that he was troubled by that bill.
He being the governor.
But, of course, the governor doesn't vote. So, you know, that bill died in the Senate. It died in the Senate committee. I think we were talking about before, but I think off the air, this bill, the bills that would have welfare recipients take drug tests, that also died. Abortions are not allowed after 20 weeks, I believe it is, because this has to deal with, that is supposedly at the point where the fetus feels pain, also died.
What's the status, speaking of abortion, of the personhood bill?
It is actually coming up for a vote in either committee or subcommittee tomorrow.
Okay, so I promised people we'd get to you about education.
Okay, okay.
Because there's so much going on here. Right. I mean, one of the criticisms the Republicans have gotten is that both when the current governor, Bob McDonnell, ran for governor, and when many of the people who now control majorities in the House and the Senate ran for their legislative offices, they focused not on the social conservative issues, mm-hmm. but the fiscal conservative issues.
Right.
When it comes to what's happening with education funding, K through 12 education, is it true that we're seeing the fiscal conservatives come out, Bob?
Yes, but the problem is Virginia for the last couple of decades has a serious problem with funding, the state funding K through 12 education and higher education. And the problem is that even though the state mandates all these programs, they have been unwilling to spend the money to meet the mandate. So what has happened this time is that under the composite index, which is a very complex formula, which we don't have time to go into, that money is going from some jurisdictions who in theory don't need them as much, to other jurisdictions that theoretically need it.
Well, let's say at least this much about the composite index. It is a formula by which the state determines which districts get how much money.
Correct.
Okay. That's a gross oversimplification, but it's also accurate.
It is also a need-based formula.
Supposedly.
Which is redistributive, based upon a whole series of variables. Now, what has happened to, like, Augusta County, Charlottesville, and Virginia Beach is that a combination of lower growth in student enrollment, et cetera, has resulted in they're not going to get as much money. Other jurisdictions like Harrisonburg, because we're seeing a growth in student, we're going to get more money. There are winners and losers, and the losers are very upset because the only option the losers have is either go to the legislature and get them to change something or before the budget is passed, or they have to cut major cuts in education or raise taxes themselves.
And there is another element here in terms of new regulations that the Republican governor, Bob McDonnell, wants about how much money local school districts need to be putting into their teachers' retirement accounts.
And that will cost, if it remains the same, that's going to cost millions of dollars in additional money the communities will have to put in. However, There is a possibility that the General Assembly may provide them an out on that. And the out would be to basically give them the authority to require all their employees to contribute 5% into their VRS, which would reduce the amount of money that they would have to put in. That
Virginia would, retirement system.
Right. That would effectively mean a 5% pay cut for basically all the teachers, K through 12 teachers in Virginia. So it's a complex budget mess, which is complicated by the fact that the state simply is not putting in the money, which in theory it promised it would put in.
So once again, we do want to hear your voice here on Virginia Insight, and a reminder that our call-in number is 888-WMRA-TALK, but we also want to make sure you know how to get your voice heard in the state capitol. So if you go to the Virginia Insight page at WMRA.org, use our easy-to-follow links so that you can determine the names of your state lawmakers. This is your member of the House of Delegates and your state senator. And then information on how to contact those people who represent your area in case you hear anything discussed here that you want to express an opinion to your legislators in the state capitol about. That's on the Virginia Insight webpage at WMRA.org. And we now have another person who advocates on a totally different issue. We're very pleased to welcome back to the Insight airwaves the woman who is the Virginia coordinator of the Campaign for Children's Mental Health, as well as director of policy for the group Voices for Virginia's Children, Margaret Nimmo Crow. Welcome back to Virginia Insight.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So how happy are you with what the General Assembly looks like it's doing on children's mental health or is not doing?
Well, I'll tell you, the good news about children's mental health is it's not nearly as controversial as some of the issues you all have been talking about. but unfortunately, at this point in the process, we're still not sure where we stand. We won't know until Sunday, February the 19th. But what we're working on is additional funding for children's crisis response services and also for child psychiatry. And these are both things that have been recommended by McDonald's own administration, and we know that they're things that actually save money in the short term, keeping kids out of the hospital and out of the juvenile justice system.
So tell me what it is in terms of how much money you want and what your chances are of getting it.
Okay, well, our group is actually advocating for two of the top priorities that came out of Governor McDonald's Department of Behavioral Health. They are $16 million for crisis response projects. That would be five projects, one in each region of the state, that would have both a mobile crisis team component and also a crisis stabilization unit, which is a house or a place with 6 to 8 beds where kids can go if they need to get out of their home on a short-term basis. These are for kids who are experiencing a psychiatric crisis. And we know from other places that have done this that if you bring in folks, highly trained clinicians, to the home or the school or the detention center, wherever the child's experiencing the crisis, you can actually, in many cases, prevent hospitalization. So it's cheaper and it's much less traumatic for the child and the family.
I have a question. Bob Roberts. The state has just entered into an agreement basically to deinstitutionalize thousands of Virginians who are being held, basically treated in state facilities.
Yes.
Are there any youth in those facilities that will be affected by that agreement with the Justice Department?
There are not. We no longer house kids in the in the training centers. But I think that's a really important point, because the Department of Justice settlement is actually all about folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Okay.
It does nothing to impact children's mental health per se, particularly in terms of community-based services. So unfortunately, while that reaching the settlement was a good thing, and the merits of that settlement can be debated by those in that field, it really does nothing to affect the group of kids we're talking about.
Okay.
And by the way, this is a much more pervasive problem than I think most people realize. One in five kids actually has a mental health disorder. There are as many as 100,000 children in Virginia who suffer from a serious mental illness. So this is not, you know, the kid equivalent of the worried well. These are children who have serious diagnoses, things like bipolar disorder, and they need treatment. And if we don't help them access that treatment now, we know they're going to end up in a hospital. We know they're going to end up in a residential treatment facility that we as taxpayers will likely be paying for, or they're going to end up in a juvenile justice facility. So we think this makes sense both from sort of a humanitarian perspective and also from a fiscal perspective.
And also one of the big things that you're pushing is as much money as possible in mental health overall for children and adults going to community-based services?
Absolutely. You know, the situation is a little bit different for children than it is for adults. There are multiple psychiatric hospitals run by the state for adults. There's just one left for kids. It's the Commonwealth Center in Stanton. It has 48 beds, and one of the disturbing trends we're noticing is that the readmission rate at the Commonwealth Center is actually going up. This means that kids are bouncing back after they get discharged from the center. And they attribute that directly to the fact that there are not community-based services in much of the state to help kids. When they get in a crisis or they start escalating and they're having problems, there's nothing to keep them out of the hospital again, so they keep bouncing back.
Margaret Nimmo-Crow from the Campaign for Children's Mental Health and the group Voices for Virginia's Children. Margaret, thanks so much for making time for us there in the midst of a busy season in the state capitol. And by the way, we understand a couple weeks from now you're actually going to be here in studio with us talking about some other updates on children's mental health once some of these budget decisions have been made in Richmond.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that. And I would just encourage all your listeners who care about this that they can go to your website and they can contact their legislators about these funding issues. There's still time. You know, anytime in the next few days, it would be great to let your legislators know that you care about kids' mental health and you want to see these initiatives funded.
Margaret, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
888-967-2825 is our call-in phone number. That's 888-WMRA-TALK. If you want to join our discussion, taking a look at some of the top issues being discussed in Richmond now that we are almost halfway through this year's Virginia General Assembly session. We were talking about education.
Mm-hmm.
We got through some description of the confusion about what's going on with funding, Bob Roberts. Tell me about what's going on with teacher tenure.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Governor McDonald met with Jeb Bush recently about education reform, and one of the issues he talked about was teacher tenure reform. And apparently what has come out of the committee in the House and this similar bill working its way through the Senate is a modification of teacher tenure. And the current system works whereby after 3 years, a teacher would go from being a probationary teacher to non-probationary and would be on a continuing contract. The reform that apparently is going to come out of both the Senate and the House in some form, not identical, is going to, for new teachers, not existing teachers, they would be on a 5-year probationary period. And after the 5 years, they would go on to a 3-year, term contract. So after those each 3-year period, they theoretically could be terminated without cause. And so it would dramatically change the nature of teacher tenure in the Commonwealth of Virginia for new teachers, not existing teachers.
How much support does this kind of change have?
It's hard to judge it. I mean, Virginia never has had a great uproar about teachers in the state. Teachers are very well respected. There's never been a great deal of concern about incompetent teachers teaching in Virginia. There is a national reform to try to hold teachers accountable, and therefore I think this is much more part of a national reform than simply the problems in the state of Virginia. The governor is strongly behind these provisions. It appears in the House there's strong support for them. It's not clear of how strong the support is in the Senate. And so if it fails, it's going to be because opposition in the Senate and not probably because opposition in the House.
888-WMRA-TALK, our phone number, 888-967-2825. From Bridgewater, Donna, thanks for using that number and calling in. Your question or comment for Bob Roberts and or Anita Kumar, please.
Yes. I was wondering what the status of the idea that there would be funding cuts for educational specialists from the public television, and these people go to help in-service and pre-service teachers. So I will take your answer off the air.
Thanks, Donna. Anita, do you know much about what's going on with funding for public broadcasting?
Right. The governor introduced his budget in December and did reduce, or actually I think eliminate, funding for public broadcasting, which he has tried to do before. We do not know what the House and Senate are thinking about doing with that. Their budgets come out on, as was indicated earlier, Sunday, February 19th, so in about a week and a half.
I can tell you what they're thinking about doing.
Yeah.
Because I'm psychic.
Yeah, and I was about to tell you, I'm going to guess that it's not going to be there. The House of Delegates has long tried to eliminate funding for public broadcasting, so I'm guessing in their version it will be gone. The Senate's a little bit unclear. I'm guessing that probably, as it's now Republican-controlled, it will likely also be gone from there.
And the way that it works, because we now have, in essence, a Republican majority in the Senate, as well as a Republican, large Republican majority in the House,
mm-hmm.
and the House has, as you say, many years in a row tried to cut all funding for public broadcasting. Since this is Governor McDonald's own budget, I understand, Bob Roberts, that if the Senate doesn't go along with the governor's proposal to get rid of this funding, he can just write in an amendment when the budget finally comes to him. And would they need a two-thirds majority to get rid of that amendment?
He could line item it out. That's one.
I mean, he'd have to be like a veto. They'd have to have.
Yeah, but there's a difference between a line item and an amendment. He could then, after the fact, send back a proposal to the legislature to cut it out, which would take a simple vote, majority of either House or Senate. Or he could, before that, even use a line item, which would be they would have to override. Often the governor would choose.
There is some way the governor could choose, because this is the first time that this biennial budget is his proposal. Previously, he was working off of the budget that had been submitted by his predecessor, a Democrat.
Right.
So the technicalities of how it works when the governor is proposing his own budget, he could construct it so he would need so that the legislature would need a two-thirds majority of both houses to overrule him.
Yes, if he decides to use a line item.
So it could be set up so that there's no way that public broadcast supporters in the House and the Senate are going to come up with a two-thirds majority.
No, I mean, no.
So when I was telling Anita I was psychic,
It's
a pretty good chance that public broadcast funding is gone. Donna, long explanation. One other thing that we are not sure of, because you mentioned about PBS, a certain kind of, this is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. With me, Anita Kumar of The Washington Post and Bob Roberts from James Madison University. We're chuckling here because usually we have a technical plan for keeping me from talking too much. Didn't work this past time. So we're going to move on here. The one thing that I did want to let our previous caller, Donna, know, there is some select funding that relates specifically to special education programs that some public broadcast stations do, that is separate from the state funding for public broadcasting as a whole, the sort of overall contribution made to television and radio stations across Virginia from state government that usually I think amounts to like 8 or 9% of their budgets. We're pretty sure that 8 or 9% of their budget's money is going away, but some of that smaller amount of money, for example, at WMRA, that's used for our service for the visually disabled. That money is likely to stay in the budget. So if I could make it any more confusing, I could, but that's the best I'm going to do right now. Also joining us by phone from the state capitol is the Democratic State Senator from Bath County, who also represents too many counties to mention, but in our area, it includes portions of Nelson County and Albemarle County and the city of Charlottesville. Cree Deeds, thanks for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Cree, we haven't mentioned what's been happening in this session of the General Assembly that has to do with voting rights. And it's, I'm just here by your side, that's an issue that you care about. So tell us from your view what's been happening.
Here's the thing. You know, we have one of the worst voter participation records in the free world, I guess. And we ought to be about opening up the process and making sure that more people have access and are encouraged to participate. But we seem to be discouraging voter participation. And after voter fraud that exists, if at all, in pretty small amounts, and you know, I'm for wiping out voter fraud wherever it exists. Fraud in general, let's wipe it out. Let's wipe it from the face of the earth. But we're throwing up roadblocks, I think, that are primarily going to affect poor people and people of color, younger voters and black voters, in particular things like a bill has passed the Senate to require people to have IDs on election day. And that's not a big deal for most of us. 89% of the people in this country have IDs, but 11% don't. And those people just happen to be, for the most part, older voters and poor voters and voters of color. We passed a bill to take away a person's right to absentee vote on the day they register to vote and say, well, we're going to have a waiting period, a five-day waiting period before you can absentee vote, which also is another impediment to participation. And, you know, it's just a step in the wrong direction, in my view.
On the bill that's come out,
this is Bob Roberts.
On the bill that's come out of the Senate and being considered in the House on a voter ID,
right?
What is in that bill regarding what will constitute adequate voter ID, or you're forced to vote a provisional ballot, which then you have to then provide, come back and verify?
Well, the list was broadened, frankly, and the list is better than it was when the bill was introduced. And I don't have the bill in front of me, so I don't know. I can't give you the whole laundry list, but the list was broadened in the Senate and, frankly, is much more acceptable than it was in the beginning. But here's the point. Before this, if this law takes effect today, if you walk into the ballot box, walk into the polling place without an ID, and you sign a form affirming that you are who you say you are, you cast your vote goes in the box, it counts.
Right.
You don't have to come back. Now you've got to return by the next day when provisional votes are counted with an ID. Well, you know, that might work for a lot of us, but for some of us it won't, and that to me is just unacceptable.
So what's the chance this is going to become law, Cree?
Well, I think it'll pass the House of Delegates. I mean, lots of things pass over there, and the governor, I think, has indicated that he'll sign it. So I think there's a pretty good chance it becomes law.
In terms of voting, what's the status of redistricting? Do I understand correctly that pretty much districts as incumbents want them, the 8 members of Congress who are Republicans from Virginia and the 3 members of Congress from Virginia who are Democrats, are keeping their districts mostly intact?
Well, with a few changes. For example, the 5th district is narrowed down, but it runs from Danville to Warrenton now, and it's basically the plan that has passed is drawn to reelect incumbents and the lock in place for the next 10 years, the 8-3 Republican-Democrat split in the congressional delegation. Here's the issue. Certain citizens sued in both federal and state court, and the state court judge said, you know, the law, the Constitution says what it means. The Constitution of Virginia says that the General Assembly shall draw the lines in 2011. Well, that doesn't mean you can draw them in 2012. In 2011, the House of Delegates passed this plan that cements in the incumbents. The Senate passed a different plan, and a plan that has a minority-majority district and a minority-influence district. African Americans are 19% of the population of Virginia. That's close to 20%. I think that means that they have a right to elect or have an influence on the election of 2 Congress people. And so we worked pretty hard in the Senate to come up with a plan that creates as as well as possible, compact contiguous districts and keep communities of interest together, but we created a black majority district and a black influence district. It's up to the courts now. I think it's pretty clear, you know, that the courts are going to resolve the redistricting issue one way or the other. The plan that cements in the incumbents has passed both houses now, and been signed by the governor. If the courts will allow that plan to be accepted, it will be. But otherwise, the General Assembly or the courts will likely draw the new congressional line.
Cree, I'm confused about what the Virginia Supreme Court would do, or Virginia courts, on the suit dealing with the General Assembly and timing. If the court said the General Assembly was wrong,
right.
In other words, what would the remedy be?
The remedy would be for the courts to draw the lines.
So has a Virginia court ever redrawn?
I can't answer that. Okay. I can tell you that there have been instances where, I think in 81, the plans were thrown out and the courts, the state courts, or I mean, I think the federal courts.
Federal courts, correct.
Threw it back to the General Assembly to come up with new plans. I mean, I think that's one potential remedy. The courts could throw it back to the General Assembly. You could end up with the same sort of district plan you've got now. That's one plan, but another possible remedy would be for the courts to draw the lines, and that's what's occurred in other states.
Okay.
Cree Deeds, who represents the Virginia State Senate's 25th district, a Democrat. Cree, always good to talk to you. Thank you for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or comment about what's going on in Virginia politics, we've got just a few more minutes to take calls at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2820 now. 2825. Oh, boy, tongue's not working. I mean, even worse than usual today. Okay. Now, with us now from the state capitol is the House of Delegates member who represents the House's 20th district, including the cities of Stanton and Waynesboro, as well as at least a part of Augusta, Highland, and Nelson counties. He is a Republican in his second term in office. Dickie Bell, good to talk to you again, sir.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm having tongue problems, so I'm going to try and shut up and let you talk as much as possible after I ask you what's happening in your deaf children's rights legislation.
Well, that bill has actually, it was sent to appropriations, which is, as most people who know anything about what goes on down here realize that's sometimes where bills go to die. But we have resuscitated it there. And it has come out of appropriations. It will be going to the House floor. I expect probably Monday we'll get the first reading. I don't think it's going to be there tomorrow, but it could be. But we will at least be able to have a vote on it before crossover, it looks like.
Tell us what it does.
Well, it is, I think it was misappropriately named Deaf Child Bill of Rights in one of the titles, and all it does really is to ensure that these deaf and hard of hearing children receive the accommodations and the necessary services that they're already entitled to that are outlined under federal law in IDEA. In some places, they're just not getting them, and placement decisions that are being made are not, in every case, are not the least restrictive environment for a specific child. If they have a severe hearing loss or they are severely deaf, they just are going to school in places where they don't have the resources to provide services that have already been outlined for them. We're just trying to make this playing field a little more even for them.
Bobby, you had a question for Delegate Bell on a completely different subject.
Yeah, what is your position on the Amazon tax bill that is going through the legislature? In other words, you're aware that Amazon has announced it's going to build some distribution centers in Virginia. And
right.
Now the question is whether Virginia is going to be able to collect sales taxes.
Right.
Are you in support of it? Or what is the General Assembly in support of that? That way to deal with online sales?
I think it's going to be interesting to see. I get the general feeling that there's a lot of support for doing that. Now, I will tell you this. I've heard from some of my very conservative constituents and a few other people that it amounts to a tax increase on the consumer who's not paying that tax now for shopping with Amazon. I think that might be a little bit of a stretch. I see where they're making the argument. I'm not sure I agree with it completely.
I would think you would have an awful lot of brick-and-mortar retailers in your district, Delegate Bell, who say, wait a minute, when people go online and they don't have to pay the 5% Virginia sales tax, that actually is a 5% discount that works against me because at my store I have to charge the 5 cents on every dollar.
And you're exactly right, Tom, and that's the other side of the coin. And I have heard from all kinds of retail businesses who do feel that way. And their point is, well, I'll tell you, it's a very legitimate concern. It creates somewhat of a non-competitive situation for them. So I think in this climate of no taxes and never raise a tax or create a new one, I think it will cause some problems for legislation like this. But I also think that in the interest of fairness, we got to give it a good, loud hearing. Because
so it sounds like if it comes to the floor for a vote, you have not yet decided which way you're going to go.
I haven't. And the only reason, though, the reason I say that is because from the time of these things are conceived until the time we get to vote on them, so much happens to them. And if it came to me as a clear up and down yes or no vote on should we apply this to Amazon, then I think I would probably lean toward doing that. But if it comes in with a bunch of baggage and some other attachments to it that I can't live with, then you know, I may have to change that position. But I do think it's worthy enough that we should be talking about it. I think something needs to be done.
Republican member of the House of Delegates from Stanton, Dickie Bell. I understand we pulled you out of a committee meeting and we got you there on a sort of cranky cell phone, but I sure do appreciate you taking a few minutes to spend with us. Good to talk to you, Dickie. And we just lost his cell phone. just in time. We got just maybe one more minute. If there's somebody listening who wants to call right now, we might be able to squeeze it in at 888-WMRA-TALK as we continue looking at what's going on with our General Assembly as they're getting close to the all-important crossover day. Phone number 888-967-2825. Anita Kumar, I understand you spent some time with our governor earlier today. What happened?
I did. He had a press conference today with members of Virginia 21. That's a group that represents basically the younger voters, college students. And they were advocating for more money for higher education. And the governor's put about $200 million in his proposed budget for that. And the students came with 10,000 petitions to give to legislators saying that their tuitions are too high. So this is a way. They're hoping that if the state gives the colleges more money, then their tuition won't go sky high.
But didn't he also take a swipe at his predecessor, saying it's their fault that tuition's gone up some?
He has mentioned several times now that this is, you know, 10 years of problems that have been going on, that the colleges and universities were underfunded. And he has mentioned that Governors Warner, now Senator Warner, and Governor Kane, now a Senate candidate, had created these problems.
You're laughing, Bob Roberts. You want to explain?
Yes. The problem is when this goes way, way back to the 1980s. Whenever the state has a budget crisis, there's an easy way for the legislature to act. In other words, what you do is you cut the operating budget, state funds for general revenue to universities, and you simply wink and blink and say, go ahead, raise your tuition. And so this was what the General Assembly wanted done, not the governors, not Tim Kaine, and it's not Warner. It's a General Assembly. Found it very, very convenient to simply say, we're going to cut the amount of money we're giving you out of general funds. Go ahead and raise your tuition because that's more politically acceptable than raising taxes. And so for the governor to blame this on Kaine and Warner is just not accurate. It's what the General Assembly wanted done, and because it was a simple way to avoid having to raise taxes. And in fact, Tim Kaine did propose in his last budget before he left office to raise taxes.
Okay, I want to be really risky here. We've got Tom in Waynesboro who just called in. Tom, we've got about 20 seconds both to take your question and respond. So make it quick, please.
I'll take comment off the air. I just want to say any public broadcasting funds, I don't think they should be canceled. They've been cut back far enough already.
Thank you for making that comment. I had no idea what he was going to say. Uh-huh. I didn't plan that.
Sure.
Anybody want to respond?
I agree. I mean, I think I think the problem is that the conservatives perceive public broadcasting as a liberal communications device, and therefore they misconceive that it's really not.
I wish I had the tape ready to play it, but we're out of time anyways. All of the times I've heard Senator Emmett Hanger, Republican, say that he supports public broadcasting because it's the one place where he feels people are still encouraged to do respectful, reasonable dialogue. Bob Roberts and Anita Kumar, thank you both for doing that.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on programs, and then clicking on Insight Archives. And if you go to that page, you will find easy-to-follow links for discovering who your state representatives are and information on how to contact them should you care to do so. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.